Hello and welcome to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Will Bain with you today. Great as always to have your company. On the programme, the almost decade-long battle over how much tax Apple pays in Europe looks to be coming to an end. We'll be live in Dublin in just a moment to get reaction after Europe's Competition Commission ruled the iPhone maker must now pay €13 billion back in taxes in Ireland. Also on the programme, ahead of the first debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris tonight, we're off on the trail of America's young workforce. What do they want to hear?
It is virtually impossible for somebody as a Gen Z person to survive in this economy.
It kind of is scary as someone who's just entering the workforce, kind of not knowing what your future holds.
Yeah, we'll have much more on that and plenty more to come over the next half hour here on World Business Report. We're going to kick off, though, in Europe, where a long-running battle over how much tax Apple pays looks to have reached a dramatic conclusion today. On Tuesday, Europe's top court ruled Apple had benefited from what's termed a sweetheart deal, i.e. a favourable tax rate to attract investment in one of the bloc's members, namely the Republic of Ireland. The European Court of Justice said its ruling confirms the European Commission's 2016 decision. Ireland granted Apple unlawful aid, which Ireland is required to recover. The amount to recover? More than $14 billion. The European Union's Competition Commissioner, Marguerite Vestager, hailed the verdict as a victory for tax justice.
Today is a big win for European citizens and for tax justice. The Court of Justice confirmed the decision from 2016 by the European Commission. Ireland granted Apple unlawful aid, which Ireland now has to recover. And this judgment is final. The court also confirms the Commission decision in the Google Shopping antitrust case. And also this is a final judgment.
Well, with more on the background, here's our correspondent, John Campbell.
Well, really what the EU was alleging, and what has now been found to have been the case, was that Apple basically got an unfair subsidy. It got a sweetheart tax deal from the Irish authorities. And EU countries, they're allowed to make their own tax arrangements. That isn't decided by the European Commission in Brussels. But what EU countries mustn't do is give unfair advantage to one company over another. And that's what Apple is found to have done. Now, this has been a very long process, a very long legal process, but it's now at an end. The EU, the European Commission, has won. Apple has lost. The bizarre thing, though, in this is that the Irish government has also lost. It supported Apple. But the loser here, the Irish government, now is going to have to collect €13 billion plus interest, which will go into its country's coffers. It is most likely to do something quite boring with it, which is to pay down some of Ireland's national debt. The other thing it could potentially do is use this money to help boost Ireland's sovereign wealth fund. So Ireland has just recently set up a sovereign wealth fund that it's going to use to invest.
The BBC's John Campbell there explaining the background to all of that. In just a moment, we'll get more about the wider implications for particularly big technology firms and their tax status. But first, we're joined live from Dublin by Paul Murphy. Paul's from the People Before Profit Party and sits in Ireland's Parliament. Paul, thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
Thanks for having me on.
Paul, you and the party have campaigned on this for a number of years, so I guess pretty pleased with the decision today.
Yes, definitely. I mean, we think this is a very good day for ordinary people in Ireland. Ironically, as your correspondent pointed out, it's a bad day for the government. I mean, the government has spent significant public money, about €10 million, to fight this case, to say, no, we don't want this €13 billion plus that was owed by Apple, one of the richest corporations in the world, to the state, and instead it should stay in Apple's very, very sizable cash pile. So the Irish government has been defeated, but the consequence is that now there is an extra over €13 billion a couple of weeks away from a budget, a few weeks or months at most away from an upcoming general election. And certainly for us now, there's going to be a focus on, okay, what can that money be spent on? With a huge housing crisis, with a huge health crisis, with inadequate action in terms of climate. Now, there's a whole lot of money that could and should be used for capital investment in those areas.
Yeah, interesting, the political backdrop of it all, as you say. I mean, the government fought it, right, because successive Irish governments have really made this bet, haven't they, that attracting particularly American technology firms, some of the biggest on the planet, to come and set up shop in Ireland has been beneficial, and that they would argue, if they were here, that the benefits of employment and the people spending who are employed on those salaries was worth it for those tax deals?
Yeah, I mean, let's be blunt. Their strategy has been for Ireland to be a corporate tax haven. Ireland is a particular type of corporate tax haven. It's a corporate tax haven conduit where money flows through Ireland, out of Ireland, without any tax being paid on it. I mean, in 2014, Apple paid 0.005% of tax on its profits. All of its European sales were routed through Ireland. No taxes were paid on those. We are opposed to that model of Ireland being a corporate tax haven. We don't think it's a sustainable model. Someone else can come along, Trump, for example, and say we'll do 0.004% or 0.003%. It isn't a sustainable way to build your economy.
But in the short or medium term, how do you make that transition, though? Because literally thousands of jobs depend on these companies, and if they were suddenly to go, well, you know what, we haven't got that status anymore, we'll make the decision ourselves before someone, like you say, even offers them that. If they make the decisions themselves, a lot of people could be out of work pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's two points I'd make there. One is that you have to separate out the real economy, the real activities of these multinational corporations, and their tax haven activities or tax avoidance activities. So if you take the companies that were at the center of this scam by Apple, it was a company called Apple Operations Europe and Apple Sales International. Those corporations had no employees in Ireland. They didn't produce any wealth in Ireland. They were simply kind of holding entities that money flowed through in order to avoid paying tax. There's a difference between that and Apple's actual real operations, where they're 5,000 workers in Cork producing Apple computers, iPhones, and so on. So those are real wealth producing activities that make money for Apple, separate from their use of Ireland as a corporate tax haven. The same applies to the other multinational corporations. And the second point, though, is this point about sustainability. I mean, we now have this 13 billion euro windfall, and that money should now be invested in order to put us on a more sustainable track. For us, that's a very different model of an economy. It's not being in hock to these multinational corporations, not trying to win a race to the bottom in terms of tax rates, in terms of regulation, in terms of data protection. That's the race to the bottom that the Irish state is trying to win. Instead, we're for a model where people come before profit, where we have public ownership, public investment of the key sections of the economy, and we plan for people's needs as opposed to always putting the corporations first.
But it is a global competition now, isn't it? We talk about this in all sorts of sectors, Paul, on the program, in all sorts of different countries. Not Ireland specific, is it? But countries are now in economic competition with each other to attract some of these biggest players in the world to there, because they are the wealth generators. They are the job providers, and what you call a scam, the Irish government and Apple would say are preferential tax treatments that are part of that battle, that are just part of that reality.
I mean, one thing I disagree with you on is I would say the wealth creators are the ordinary workers for Apple in Ireland and around the world. They're the ones who are the real wealth creators. But I absolutely agree with you that there is this competition between states, and is what has driven, in the context of free capital flows, it has driven average corporation tax rates down and down and down. You can look at graphs from going from the kind of mid-80s or so, the onset of neoliberalism, and corporate tax rates in real terms absolutely plummet. We say that that is a race that ultimately the only winners from are the big corporations. Different countries
really?
Can
I mean,
benefit
we're speaking
temporarily.
To you in Dublin. I mean, Dublin is a city that's transformed, isn't it, in the last decade?
I wouldn't argue, though, that it is transformed on the basis of being a corporate tax haven. I mean, you can wander down to the IFSC, which is the equivalent of the City of London, and you can visit multiple buildings which supposedly host 50, 60, 100, 200 corporations, of which there isn't a light on. Nobody's working there. These are simply shell holding operations in order to avoid paying tax. Maybe there's some accountants employed to like deal with this. But that is not real wealth creation in terms of benefiting our society or even benefiting our economy. So while there may be occasional kind of short-term arbitrage type winners out of this, the long run is a shift of wealth from ordinary people, ordinary workers, taxpayers, to big, very, very wealthy, very, very powerful corporations. And we think that is a bad thing. We should resist that race to the bottom as opposed to trying to win the race to the bottom, which is what the Irish state has been involved in and has now been caught out.
What do you think should happen with this money now? What will you guys be arguing in the run-up to that election you were talking about, Paul? What will you be arguing that the money should be used for? We should say that we've had a statement in the last few minutes, actually, since we've been on air from the Irish Finance Ministry. You aren't certain exactly how much of all of that money they will get, the full $14 billion that other states within the European Union may make claims on it from now. But setting that aside, where do you think this money would be best spent?
Yeah, we have an enormous housing crisis. I mean, we have 14,000 people, over 14,000 on the emergency accommodation. We have an enormous health crisis, a million people waiting for various hospital beds. We're only slightly over half the EU average in terms of beds per head of population. And like I said, we're absolutely failing in terms of our climate targets. We're failing in terms of biodiversity crisis. And they basically are the areas that we think this money needs to be invested in. And if you took all the money and invested in housing, you could build 40,000 homes. I mean, that would go a long, long way to resolve the housing crisis. You could invest it in adding significant hospital capacity, building a national health service that we need to have in this country. And you should invest it in expanding public transport, investing in free public transport, investing in retrofitting, getting people out of cars, reducing people's energy usage, and so on. So there is no shortage of things that the money could be spent on. And we think, I mean, I think it's likely the Irish state is going to say, oh, we'll pay down debt, or we'll put it into a fund into the that'll be used in the future. Whereas we think the investment needs to be made now. And for example, if you build houses, well, you're going to get a return on those houses in terms of rent. So it will be money well spent.
Paul, thanks so much for your time this afternoon. Paul Murphy there from the People Before Profit Party in the Irish Parliament. Well, Peter Vale, tax partner at Grant Thornton in Ireland, is also joining us from the Irish capital. Peter, afternoon. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon.
I saw you talking to RTE, the state broadcaster, a little earlier, saying that you thought this was a blow to Ireland's reputation. Why?
I think today's ruling was a surprise. I think most people expected if we were going to get a final ruling, it would have gone the other way. I think at worst, a ruling in favour of Apple in Ireland, I think we thought at worst it would have been kicked back to the General Court. So yes, it was a surprise, and I think in the short term, potentially reputational damaging. I think, you know, this relates to historic periods. Our tax regime has been fundamentally overhauled since then. So, and I think that's important. So I think while short term, yes, we will take a reputational hit, I don't think medium to long term we will. I think we can ride this out. I think, look, we have a tax regime that has been fully endorsed by the OECD in terms of transparency. I think we have a lot of credit in the bank. So again, yes, short term, not a good day for Ireland, I would say, from a reputational perspective. But, you know, medium to long term, I think it's okay in terms of the ability to continue to attract that foreign direct investment that's been so critical to Ireland's development success the last 50 years.
And what about beyond Apple? Do you see this having implications for any of those other big tech firms, or do you think there's a line under this issue at this point?
Yeah, I think there's a line. I think there's a line under it. Well, I think it was quite a nuanced structure. I don't see it having wider implications for other big multinationals. So they're here in terms of other legacy structures that we know have been completely overhauled and aren't in place anymore. But regardless, I don't see this as having any wider implications.
And just give us your take on the significance of this sector to the Irish economy, though, and its future prospects.
Yeah, it's obviously been a massive sector, the foreign direct investment sector in Ireland, in terms of direct employment, in terms of VAT receipts, payroll receipts, corporation tax as well. Our corporation tax receipts have more than doubled in 2 to 3 years. Almost, perhaps ironically, but that's what's happened, because you're seeing a much greater alignment now of tax for profits and real substance. So there is a lot of employment, real employment in Ireland. So the new tax world has actually been favourable to Ireland in terms of the collection of corporate tax receipts. So I don't see a threat. I don't see a threat of behavioural changes of companies moving out of Ireland as a result of this, or indeed as a result of other global tax changes over the last decade. They have all, as I say, been more about substance, and that's been good for Ireland. So I don't see today moving the dial on that.
Peter, thanks so much for your time. Peter Vale there, tax partner at Grant Thornton in Ireland. Plenty more on that story on our website too, bbc.com/business. You're with World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Let's take you to the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, now. And anyone who's arrived there by plane recently might be very familiar with our next issue. The country's main airport, Jomo Kenyatta International, is in need of a little TLC to try and do that. The Kenyan government has been looking for private investors to partner with, and they thought they'd found one in the form of the giant Indian conglomerate Adani Group. The Indian firm's potential involvement, though, has sparked a backlash, including protests by Kenya's Aviation Workers Union. To explain more, Brian George, business journalist with the Nation Media Group in Nairobi, takes up the story for us.
The facility is Kenya's biggest and oldest airport by far, and was incorporated or rather built during the independence time. And what has happened is that the facility, the airport itself, has pretty much degenerated with recent reports about leaking roofs, terminals that are not up to standard compared to the global standards. And so it was concerning for the government to want to have a facility that is up to standard. And so at the onset of this regime, the new regime that came in 2022, there was already conversations about public-private partnerships in terms of addressing key strategic government facilities and other institutions and the like. So JKIA was earmarked for some of these projects.
So at this point, enter Adani, giant conglomerate, one of the biggest on the planet, Indian-owned, saying that they could be the company to provide the private bit of that partnership you were talking about. Why was that controversial?
Well, you see, first of all, we must appreciate the fact that this is not the first build-operate-transfer facility that Kenya has. Let's first look at what the situation surrounding Adani's supposed takeover of JKIA. So one is that they needed to take over this airport and manage, operate, develop, upgrade up to 30 years, which is under the BOT kind of framework, the build-operate-transfer. But why there's an uproar, really, is that Kenyans feel like, number one, their jobs are on the line. Adani had proposed a two-year transitional contract period for airport workers. This was not welcomed by the union. And then the other question also is that the kind of financing that was going into this project was 97 billion Kenya shillings, which is an equivalent of about 750 million US dollars, which was going to construct, to reconstruct a whole new terminal in that facility to upgrade its standards. And then another extra 90 million US dollars was going to be used to construct new taxi runways and the likes. And so the other question that Kenyans are asking is that, can't this money be gotten from our taxes or financed otherwise? Is this potentially going to increase the cost of air travel and the cost of running airports? Those are the main issues why Kenyans are up in arms about this Adani deal.
And I suppose the flip of that, the concern would be, as you pointed out right at the start, Brian, this work is pretty urgent. It's needed. And another delay only makes the problem worse and more expensive.
Kenyans are not opposed to development of facilities as it's coming out. Not at all. The only question is that why is it shrouded in a lot of secrecy? The due process hasn't been followed. And then the circumstances surrounding it, we do not need, or rather Kenyans are saying they do not need to have a project that is running for 30 years and a private company is profiting off of it, and the certain circumstances are not assured. For example, the last trigger was on the job security, which is why the Kenya workers, Kenya Airport Workers Union was on the streets protesting Adani's entrance into the Kenyan market.
Yeah, I should say we approached Adani for a statement. They did not get back in contact with us, but they have indicated they're going to appeal, and it sounds like that appeal could be in early October, so I'm sure something will return to on the programme. Let's turn to Fiona Sincotta, Senior Market Analyst at City Index in London, who's been looking at what's been moving financial markets today. Fiona, great to have you back on the programme. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Just on Apple then, and we talked about them right at the top of the programme. A little bit of reaction from the shares this morning, but not a huge move.
No, completely. I mean, there was a little bit more movement pre-open, but that sell-off has really sort of paired itself. It's just down around 0.7%. And I mean, although this is a big fine that we're talking about, if we do just sort of keep in mind that revenue, for example, for Apple in the most recent earnings in the quarter was 84 billion. So, you know, 30 yeah. million billion is a large number, but you know, when you think about the amount that they're bringing in as well, it's
And when we're talking quarters, so we need huge. 3 months of the year, don't we?
So, exactly. Yeah, so you need to times that by four.
Is that the important context as well then for the fine that Google got from the European Union today as well?
Yeah, I think that's a similar story as well, in the sense that, you know, I mean, if we look at the Alphabet share price, they're the owners of Google, the parent company to Google. They're actually trading higher today. So I think that just really, you know, it shows us how investors are just literally shrugging this news off as far as those fines are concerned. And I mean, it doesn't seem to be anything new. We know that sort of there's been a lot of trouble between the European Union and Alphabet and Google as far as sort of market dominance and abuse of market dominance. And
And sticking with a bit of tech, one of Apple's big competitors had this announcement today. Suitably futuristic music for a futuristic phone, Fiona. It was a sort of three-way folding £2,500 phone from Huawei.
I know. I loved this. I mean, this is sort of like the ultimate design. It seems to sort of bring luxury, innovation, and a very hefty price tag with it, you know. But it does seem to be taking the shine away from the Apple iPhone 16 unveiling as well. So I think that just really shows us that company Huawei are really ready to take on Apple for the dominance in the smartphone, global smartphone market.
Yeah, been sanctioned just about everywhere in the world at points, been certainly in the middle of a lot of trade wars, trade tensions over the years, Huawei, but seems to be fighting back, as Fiona says, certainly in its home market in China as well. Well, part of those trade wars and trade tensions, of course, have been politics in the United States in particular. And later on this evening, we're going to get plenty of that in prime time. The Vice President, Kamala Harris, will go head-to-head for the first time in a televised debate with former President Trump. With just a few months until the elections, one big focus is young voters aged between 18 and 27. They make up nearly one-fifth of the American electorate. But it's not just young voters who are getting attention. There's also been a surge in Gen Z candidates taking part in local elections too. As our reporter Natalie Jimenez has been catching up with a couple of young candidates ahead of that November vote, as well as the voters they're hoping to win over.
See y'all. Have a good night. You too, bro.
This is Gabriel Sanchez, 27 years old, born and raised in Cobb County, Georgia, a suburb a half-hour drive from Atlanta.
All right, I'll see y'all later.
And this is Wyatt Gable, a 21-year-old student who's in his last year of university in North Carolina. As Sanchez gets back in his car after a shift at a local sports bar, Gable gets into his on his way to start his first day back at school. But a few months ago, their day looked very different.
The short version, we won.
This election cycle, Sanchez, a Democratic candidate for Georgia State House, and Wyatt, a Republican running for North Carolina's House of Representatives, are both part of a new wave of young candidates. They both secured their party's nomination, but still need to face a final vote in November.
Hey there, sir. How are you doing today?
The morning after his night shift, Sanchez is already out knocking on doors. Meanwhile, Gable's fundraising efforts are in full swing.
Well, I appreciate everything you've been able to give, and thank you all.
For Sanchez, it's the experience of being young in this economy that's ultimately driving him.
We can't afford a home. We don't know if we're ever going to be able to buy a home. We can't afford the basic necessities that we need. We're working, you know, our tails off, and we're not seeing any rewards for it.
Gable believes it's his generation's unifying issue.
I definitely think my generation feels it, especially now this year, seeing as how bad inflation is and interest rates are and all those things are skyrocketing. That's going to be the biggest thing on people's minds.
Leading the conversation from an economist's point of view is Kyla Scanlon, also known as Gen Z's favorite econ TikToker.
Rent is still expensive. Home prices are still through the roof. And also on the other side of that coin, we're seeing a weakening labor market. It just feels like there's no beginner mode anymore. Like the bottom rung of the ladder just feels completely gone.
And that's only going to get more complicated when Gen Z starts to inherit from their parents. According to estimates by the consulting firm Cerulli Associates, around $72 trillion is set to be passed down over the next 20 years.
You know, we're about to experience the greatest wealth transfer in history. There's going to be some Gen Z and millennials who inherit homes from their boomer parents. There'll be some that don't. And like that gap is going to be really important to pay attention to.
Back in Georgia, after a day of canvassing, Sanchez is leaving the last of his flyers at people's doors.
Just taking a quick water break. It's hot.
With a few months to go until local elections in November, he tells me that the hard work has just begun. And it's now more important than ever that his generation steps up.
We need that representation. We are ready for change. We know that this economy is not working for us and leaving us behind, and we're going to be struggling our whole lives. And so that's what we're fighting for. We're fighting for a future, for a vision. And I do believe that as Gen Z candidate and as our generation, we understand that the most because we are the ones who are going to see that future unfold.
Natalie Jimenez with that report there. Fiona Cincotta still with a senior market analyst at City Index. Fiona, is that the thing that markets might be watching the most, perhaps, between now and the autumn? What goes on in the US election, and in particular, I guess, pledges, pitches from the candidates that may or may not shape things like global trade?
Yes, exactly that. You know, this becomes a sort of a very big focus for the markets, usually between the sort of July and November period of an election year. I mean, even just now we're seeing the volatility index. So that's an index which basically sort of measures the fear within the market is trading now higher than it is usually. It's at 20. It's usually an average for this year at 14.8. I mean, the other thing to keep in mind, though, is the election risk is just one risk of several risks that the US economy is facing. We've obviously got the Federal Reserve looking to cut interest rates. There are also rising concerns of a recession. So I do think that that means that there's going to be more attention than sort of potentially other election years on those economic pledges particularly.
And plenty of our attention on the late edition of World Business Report and, of course, Business Matters, Midnight GMT, all the build up to that debate with Ed Butler and the team. So do tune in for that later.